Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, March marks two anniversaries of nuclear disasters, Three Mile Island and Fukushima. We'll explore what we've learned. Then, the Crimea vote. Was it self-determination or was it coercion? But first, we launch our new monthly series with Scientific American. With us now is Fred Gutterl with the highlights in science. Fred Gutterl is the executive editor of Scientific American. Welcome, Fred Gutterl. It's great to have you with us here on the Scholar's Circle.
Well, it's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
So I thought we would start with the breakthroughs in gene therapy due to RNA discoveries. I wonder if you could first tell us a bit about when and how gene therapy was introduced and how it's been changing so far.
Well, gene therapy got a kind of a bad start. In the late 90s, there were a couple of fatal cases. It was being rolled out in a modest way, and the treatment itself wound up being fatal to a few people. And this caused the biomedical community to really take a step back and try to figure out what went wrong and how to get the whole thing back on track. Because, you know, gene therapy potentially has a huge potential. So you can go in and actually fix mutations in DNA and be very specific about what you're doing.
Well, let's talk about the RNA discoveries.
RNA is a genetic material, and it's present in every cell, but it's sort of been the weak stepsister to other types of genetic material, such as DNA, which everybody has heard about, and proteins, which you normally think of a protein as, you know, like a hamburger, but proteins are essential. They're sort of like, they're molecules that sort of carry out the instructions of DNA. So they have a little partnership going on there. And RNA was this very ephemeral genetic molecule that comes and goes, and it really is just kind of a messenger. It carries information from one part of the cell to the other. And it was thought for a long time that RNA wasn't all that interesting. It didn't really do that much. It was, you know, it was sort of like Cinderella. It was over there scrubbing the floor and nobody paid attention to it. But in the last few years, scientists have discovered new kinds of RNA that play integral roles in very important functions of the cell. And when you find new information about how the cells work, that gives you a target. So you can then take some kind of a drug, a molecule, and you can zing it to that target and affect what happens in the cell, and you can potentially come up with drugs. And so there's money pouring now into RNA research. Or drug development, really, kind of applied research. And there's an RNA target for liver cells that could be a treatment against hepatitis C, and there's a potential treatment for viruses like Ebola, which I guess a lot of people around here don't get, which is good. And it's also had a big boost to gene therapy, because an approach where you take a virus or some other kind of delivery system, and you take a virus and you attach some kind of payload onto it, and you send it into the body, and it goes into the cells, and it deposits that payload in the cell, and that payload is a bit of genetic material that then does something that you want it to do. And RNA is turning out to be a really good payload for gene therapy.
Let's turn then from the micro to the macro. We've recently had confirmation about the Big Bang Theory. Let's talk about this and how they confirmed it and what it all means for us.
Well, basically, you look at the Big Bang, and you had this event, and then scientists look into the sky, and they look at the oldest stars they can possibly look at. And because the light takes a long time to travel, the universe is expanding, and the light is traveling. The fainter the light you can see, the more distant the object is, and the further back in time you can see. This is sort of the general idea that scientists have tried to peer back in time when they look up into the sky. What they would like to do is they would like to go back to the moment when the Big Bang happened and observe it. Now, that's impossible because you just can't get back that far. But they're getting closer and closer. And a couple of things happened recently. I mean, we had a detection of gravity waves that were product of the very, very early universe. And they were predicted by the theories of quantum mechanics. And this is significant. I mean, you know, it sounds a little bit like gobbledygook, and it is very complicated. The universe is very big now, right? And very big things obey the laws of relativity. That has to do with the speed of light and what the consequences are of the speed of light having a limit. Those are one set of laws. And then you have laws of things that are really very small, and that's where quantum mechanics comes in. And these two laws, these two sets of scenarios, really, have not been reconciled. There is no single consistent way of describing things that are very small and describing things that are very big. Now, if you go back and back in time to the really early universe and the moment after the Big Bang, the universe was very, very small. It was a tiny little point. And so at that moment, the laws of quantum mechanics and the laws of relativity all applied to the universe. So it is a very long-winded way of saying that what scientists found recently were a detection of quantum mechanical behaviors in the universe. So in other words, how the universe behaved when it was really, really small. And that's pretty cool. It's a long way to go to explain it, but it's fascinating. Now, what we had a story in this month as well on, if you go back to the Big Bang, and that was about 14 billion years ago. And when the Big Bang happened, there was lots of light, right? Let there be light. There was tons of light. And then about 400,000 years ago, the universe went completely dark, and it was dark for most of the next billion years, and then suddenly it became light again. Scientists have been trying to figure out why. You know, why did this happen? Why did it go dark, and why did it go light? We have an article here written by Michael Lemonick. He wrote a really kind of a detective story about how scientists figured out how the lights went off and what turned them back on. The answers have to do with fundamental things about how galaxies form and how stars form and how it came to be that the universe is what we know it is.
So while we're exploring where no person has gone before, you also did a story about robots exploring the bottom of the ocean where we've never been able to go because of the conditions there. What do we know about the bottom of the ocean?
I've had the pleasure of talking with Sylvia Earle, who is really a champion of the ocean, and she talks about how vast the oceans are and how interesting they are and how little we know about them. We know more about the moon than we know about the deepest parts of our oceans. It sounds crazy, but it's true, and it's just very hard to explore down trenches that are miles and miles deep, 7-8 miles, some of them, and because the pressures are so large and the engineering demands of getting vehicles down there and certainly getting people down there are so difficult. Now, the interesting thing that's happened recently, you had James Cameron went down for his dive. He's shined a spotlight on this whole idea of going down in submersibles and exploring the oceans. What made his trip possible is the technology of ocean submersibles has gotten to the point where you can build these things pretty cheaply. So what you have, a bunch of people in private industry getting into this stuff. Cameron is just one example. You're getting these wealthy entrepreneurs who just think this stuff is really cool, and for a relatively modest sum of money, starting up adventures with these ventures that are about to send a whole bunch of people down to the bottom of the sea. So what we did is we decided we're going to go around and ask scientists, well, what do we want to know about the ocean? I mean, what's the agenda here? And what's the research agenda? What is it that we want to find? We've identified a whole bunch of really interesting spots in the ocean that would be great for destinations. There's a Kermadec Trench, which is down in the South Pacific, a robot vehicle, Nereus, which went down there this month. Japan will send a vehicle down there in October. And there's another one off the coast of Japan, a trench that's 10,000 meters deep, almost 11,000 meters deep. There'll be a couple of manned subs planned for that one. And it's just very exciting.
Finally, bad news of our climate seems to be getting worse. Your headline, I think this was by Michael Mann, who's been a guest on our show, suggests that we've got a danger threshold arriving in about 24 years. What does this mean for us?
It means that Michael Mann is very worried about the climate, as are many scientists. And the background to this is that UN body, the United Nations group that looks into climate, the IPCC, prepares these big reports, and it's sort of the authority that goes in and tries to sort fact from fiction. And in recent years, there's been a lot of talk about a cause in the rise of global average temperatures. There's been a lot of false rumor that global warming isn't happening and that the world has stopped warming and this sort of thing. So Michael Mann and one of our editors started talking one day, and Mann had a very interesting case that this so-called pause in the rise in temperatures is not really much of a pause at all. And even when you factor it in, that the threshold at which bad things can start to happen is really pretty close. I mean, it only pushes that threshold out a couple of years. And that threshold is in 22 years. I mean, in 22 years, we enter a zone where it's possible that some troubling things could happen. I mean, this isn't a prediction. Michael Mann's not saying that this is going to happen, but he's saying that there are possibilities that are very worrying.
The IPCC report has been leaked, and they are quite concerned that already we're seeing an effect and that the warming in the future is now, in the quote from the report that is yet to come out, suggests we have abrupt and irreversible changes coming. So it is quite concerning that this has already affected the coral reefs, the Arctic ecosystems, and they are saying that the regime shifts are going to be irreversible.
That's exactly what Michael Mann means when he talks about the danger zone in 22 years. We've seen effects, right? We know the poles are warming. We know that sea levels have risen. We know that there's been changes in intensity of storms and things like that. Although you can't attribute a specific weather pattern to climate change, you can. There are effects that we know are happening. What is worrying is when you get something that happens suddenly. When you get a, scientists call this a non-linearity. When something is linear, it changes slowly, right? It changes at a certain rate. You know, if I eat a donut, I gain a pound. If I eat two donuts, I get 2 pounds. You know, I gain 2 pounds. But what if, you know, you were eating donuts and you eat the fourth donut and you gain 100 pounds? That's the kind of abrupt change that we're talking about. And that's really worrying if that happens, because we're going along and, you know, the winters are getting a little warmer, although we've had a cold one this year. But, you know, on average, the winters are getting warmer, the poles are getting warmer. But what if we had abrupt sea level rise or we had some real big shift in weather patterns? This is not a good thing. And no one is saying this is going to happen with certainty, but you know, dang, I mean, it would be pretty bad if it happened, and we should be worried that we're increasing the odds.
Well, Fred Gutterl, executive editor of Scientific American, thank you so much.
Well, thank you. It was a pleasure.
Stay tuned. You are listening to The Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org, and I'm Maria Armudian. This week marks the 35-year anniversary of Three Mile Island's partial nuclear meltdown. The anniversary comes on the heels of the Fukushima disaster's 3-year anniversary. What have we learned from these incidents? With us is Edwin Lyman. He is a senior scientist at the Union of Concerned Scientists and also the co-author of Fukushima, The Story of Nuclear Disaster. Welcome to the Scholar Circle, Edwin Lyman. It's great to have you with us.
Good afternoon.
Well, I'd like to start with a premise that you opened your new book with, that the problems that caused Fukushima can really exist anywhere that we have reactors in existence. And what were the problems that can be replicated?
Well, I'd say the underlying issue is the level of complacency in the nuclear industry and nuclear regulators around the world. The fact is, nuclear power plants are vulnerable to a variety of different potential events that could cause them to melt down. And the level of protection that those plants have against those events is only as good as what the regulators require. And we think that it's complacency plus the economic pressure on the industry that's led to inadequate protection just about everywhere.
You also essentially said in the book that nobody expected the chain of events that occurred. No one could have predicted it. Can you walk us through that chain and why people weren't prepared?
Yes, well, it's a little hard to say no one could have predicted it. It's really a matter of when reactors are licensed, what the regulator does. And their basic approach is to establish what they call a design basis. They limit the scope of the types of accidents that they believe are likely to happen. And so they give the industry, you know, just enough space to meet those standards. They don't like to speculate. They don't like to engage in what-if scenarios because that could quickly lead to a lot of extra cost for additional safety systems. So we think that this artificial limitation of the realm of or the scope of accidents that you need to look at was the main problem. Now, what happened in Fukushima was the reactor was subject to essentially a 1-2 punch. The first was an earthquake, which was larger than the designers had ever expected. That caused a loss of off-site power, the failure of the transmission lines going into the site. Then that was followed by a tsunami, which was higher than the designers had ever anticipated, and that caused the entire site to flood, essentially disabling most of the backup electricity as well as the electrical systems. That led to a condition called a station blackout, where there was no electrical power at all, except from a few batteries that they were able to recover from cars in the parking lot. And nuclear power plants don't do very well when they don't have any electricity.
You also said at the end of the book that given the amount of radiation released, we weren't really dealing with a worst-case scenario. It wasn't Chernobyl per se. So what would you say the extent of the release and the damage were?
Well, it's still not completely known, but it does appear in the first few weeks after the accident, there were large atmospheric emissions when the cores were actively melting down, when gases were accumulating, when the reactor buildings exploded, the three of the reactors because of hydrogen buildup. But most of the radioactivity is still in the cores of the damaged reactors. And so the estimates, which are very crude, are that there was about something like 10 or 20% of the radioactivity that was emitted at Chernobyl was released into the atmosphere at Fukushima. But Fukushima actually has another pathway to the environment, and this is still ongoing because the reactors are badly damaged and they are not isolated from the groundwater that's going through the site. And as a result, there's a constant stream of radioactivity that's being washed into the sea that the reactor's operator, TEPCO, still is unable to cope with.
You also said it's classified as a level 7 accident by the IAEA. What does that number mean?
Well, it's a scale which the International Atomic Energy Agency devised to classify the severity of nuclear accidents. What level 7 really means is there was a significant release of radiation to the environment. They don't really distinguish. So Fukushima is rated level 7, just like Chernobyl was. In contrast, Three Mile Island, which occurred 35 years ago yesterday, was considered a level 5. And in that case, the reactor meltdown was stopped before it progressed as far as it did at Fukushima.
In your postmortem, in your book, you wrote about the American Nuclear Society's efforts to computer simulate the events that occurred. What was that, and what happened with their simulation?
I think that's it's a very interesting issue because the nuclear industry really would like the public to believe that they understand these systems well enough so they can run simulations and do calculations and make good estimates about the risk of accidents. But what we've learned from Fukushima is that with the tools that the industry is using to try to reconstruct what happened, there are still so many uncertainties that they're not doing a very good job of really understanding it. There are still a lot of mysteries about what happened in those reactors, and the simulation tools are only as good as the information that they can get to run the simulations. So it's a bit of a fallacy to think that through good computer modeling you can actually have a handle on how these accidents occur and how you can best prevent them.
Do you have a sense that some of the lessons learned from the Fukushima event are being taken to heart, either here or abroad?
We think that the same effect that occurred after the Three Mile Island and Chernobyl accident seems to be taking hold again, and that's the it can't happen here mentality is setting in. And as public attention wanes, as Fukushima recedes in the distance, it seems like the industry is returning to business as usual. There was certainly an attempt here in this country and other countries to try to address the problems that led to Fukushima, and I'd say these are being implemented with various levels of success. But here in the United States, some of the recommendations that were made right after the accident have been watered down. Even the ones that are being carried out are being delayed because the industry is crying foul and asking for more time. So the level of urgency that we think is appropriate to deal with these matters is simply not being sustained.
Let's return to the point of this could happen here and in any of the reactors that are in existence today. How many nuclear reactors do we still have in the U.S. that are functional? And what is their health and level of risk?
Right now, there are 100 operating new reactors, and there are, 100 operating reactors, and there are 5 under construction. A year ago, there were 104 operating reactors, and 4 of them have been shut down, including the 2 San Onofre units south of Los Angeles. There's a big range in performance of the nuclear power plants, but they are all still vulnerable to the regulatory framework that we think needs to be improved, because there are many plants that have unresolved safety issues that the Nuclear Regulatory Commission has simply not dealt with at the pace that we think they need to be addressed. Just take, for example, there are several dozen plants that are downstream of large dams, and a catastrophic dam failure that could be caused by a large earthquake could actually inundate some of those plants in such a short period of time that they would not have much time to prepare or respond. And that would lead to a situation similar to Fukushima. This is an issue the NRC has been aware of in some cases for decades, but because of the cost and complexity of trying to deal with flooding issues, they simply have not been firm and acted. The same issue is with seismic risk. It's not just the West Coast problem, but there are earthquake risks even in the eastern central United States that are larger than people appreciated when a lot of nuclear power plants were first built. And so the question is, what do you do when you find out that there's a higher earthquake risk than you design a plant to withstand? It costs a lot of money to do retrofits. So the industry has pushed back and the regulators dragged its feet.
Do you have a sense of what's going on abroad?
There's a range of responses. In Japan itself, the immediate response of the government was to shut down all the nuclear power plants in the country, or not restart them after they were shut down for maintenance. The policy of the government that was in place at the time of the accident was to phase out nuclear power. But since then, there's been a change of government, and the new government's determined to restart all those nuclear plants. How successful they'll be remains to be seen. In a country like Germany, which was on the fence about the future of nuclear power, Fukushima was the excuse to move forward with shutting them down, and they're on track to do that. But in other countries, China, for example, where there's a pretty committed policy to expand nuclear power, they took a slight pause after Fukushima, and then the government said, we're going to keep going, you know, full speed ahead. And that is probably more indicative of the attitude in most countries that are pursuing nuclear power, is to once again adopt the attitude of, that was a Japanese problem, we're going to do better, it can't happen here.
Even here, some prominent climate scientists who have been trying to address the global warming crisis, like James Hansen, for example, have argued that nuclear energy could be part of the solution.
The position of the Union of Concerned Scientists, who are agnostic on nuclear power, and we do, we are greatly concerned about the threat of climate change. So we don't ignore the fact that nuclear power could play a role in reducing greenhouse gas emissions. But you can't look at it in isolation. You have to consider the full spectrum of risks and costs associated with nuclear power. And you also have to recognize that an accident like Fukushima can help to take nuclear power off the table as an option. So we think the best way to maintain nuclear power as an option is to make sure it's as safe and secure as possible so you don't have another Fukushima. And we don't think that the industry is embracing that concept because of this underlying complacency that they still exhibit. So the industry is its own worst enemy.
Edwin Lyman, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Edwin Lyman is a senior scientist at the Union of Concerned Scientists and also the co-author of Fukushima, The Story of Nuclear Disaster. When we come back, we'll talk Crimea, Russia, self-determination, and coercion. Stay tuned. You are listening to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org, and I'm Maria Armudian. This week, with 100 yes and 11 no votes, the United Nations General Assembly passed a resolution denouncing the Crimea vote as illegal and reiterated that Crimea is still part of Ukraine's territory. Russia's response was that Crimeans have a right to self-determination and that the region had belonged to Russia long before Nikita Khrushchev gave it to Ukraine, then part of the Soviet Union. The debate raises questions about what self-determination really means and when and where the principles of self-determination or autonomy apply. With us are three experts. Stephen Fish is a professor of political science at University of California, Berkeley, and author of award-winning books including Democracy Derailed in Russia, The Failure of Open Politics, Democracy from Scratch, Opposition and Regime in the New Russian Revolution, and Post-Communism and the Theory of Democracy. Stefan Wolf also joins us. He is a professor of international security at the University of Birmingham and the author of Ethnic Conflict, Causes, Consequences, Responses, and co-author of Autonomy, Self-Governance, and Conflict Resolution and Disputed Territories, The Transnational Dynamics of Ethnic Conflict Settlement. Hurst Hannum is professor of international law at Tufts University and author of International Human Rights, Problems of Law, Policy, and Practice, and co-author of Negotiating Self-Determination and Autonomy, Sovereignty, and Self-Determination, The Accommodation of Conflicting Rights. Welcome to the Scholars Circle. Thank you so much for being with us. I'd like to start with Ukraine, Russia, and Crimea. Russia is saying that Crimea's vote is self-determination. The U.S. has said they are coerced. Stephen Fish, you've studied this region. Given what you know, what do you think is going on and whether, in fact, this is an act of self-determination or coercion? What are the lines and what's happening?
It's certainly not an act of self-determination determined as one would normally figure these things out and determine it. Self-determination is usually something that happens through an ordinary process of campaigning and voting. In this case, you have an invasion of a piece of territory in a neighboring country by Russia and a Russian-style referendum being held, which means that the media was basically shut down. Skeptical or oppositional journalists were silenced. The public arena was basically shut down and a referendum was held under the same kind of conditions that Russia holds elections in the Northern Caucasus in Russia itself. And the outcome of the referendum shows that, in fact, this probably wasn't a freely held referendum. We've got public opinion polls going back, you know, a decade or so that show that most Crimeans do want some autonomy for Crimea. But when it comes to whether they would like to be under Russian or Ukrainian tutelage, they're split. A bare majority tends to favor going with Russia. Some favor Ukraine. But this 97% vote in favor of annexation by Russia is absurd. This is clearly not a referendum in which the ballots were counted fairly. It's possible that in a referendum held under normal circumstances, not under circumstances where they were being occupied by a foreign power that wasn't held at gunpoint, that a majority still would vote to join Russia. But the point is, we just can't tell from this referendum.
Hurst Hannum, would you agree?
I agree with Stephen's criticisms of the referendum, certainly, but I think when we are talking about Ukraine and Crimea, it's important to distinguish two very different issues, and you raised them both. The first is that of self-determination or secession. Is there any right to it? Should we support it or oppose it? The second is the use of force by Russia, the invasion of Ukraine by Russia. On the second, there's no question. It was clearly an illegal invasion. It's an illegal occupation now. One might hearken back to Kosovo and recall that when Kosovo made its declaration of independence in 2008, it was occupied by NATO forces, that it had its referendum over the objections of the recognized government in Belgrade. We thought that was self-determination. And so I think what we need to do in trying to understand this is to figure out how we can not reward Russia for its use of force, and at the same time not automatically assume that Crimea will be the rest, will be part of the Ukraine from now until the end of time.
Stefan Wolf.
Yeah, I would agree with what both Stephen Fish and Hurst Hannum have said. I think the main issue here is quite clearly that the whole process by which Russia accomplished the annexation of Crimea was simply a flawed process. And so from that perspective, I mean, I've been to Crimea multiple times. I've worked a lot in the post-Soviet region. And I would very much agree with what Hurst Hannum just said, that there is probably a strong likelihood that a majority of the population in Crimea would have favored annexation to Russia or an incorporation into the Russian Federation. But the very fact that the referendum in itself was flawed, that it was not a properly negotiated process either within Crimea or within Ukraine more broadly, simply causes an additional complication here where really it is no longer about self-determination of the people of Crimea or Ukraine for that matter, but it's very much become sort of an issue of geopolitics and international relations more broadly.
Now, how does this compare to other regions? Now, you mentioned Kosovo, so maybe that's one example. Are there other areas in other regions that have had this opportunity or asked for this opportunity and faced something similar? Stefan Wolf, what do you think? You've looked at other regions and done some comparisons.
Yeah, I mean, if we just stay in the post-Soviet region, I mean, there are a number of reasonably similar cases. I mean, we have two separatist regions in Georgia that basically have been, if not annexed by Russia, then certainly put in a position where they are firmly detached from Georgia and have been recognized by a very small number of states. And there, as much as in the Transnistrian region of Moldova and in the Nagorno-Karabakh region, which is disputed between Armenia and Azerbaijan, I think there are very strong feelings of local people that they are simply not happy with the current institutional arrangement. And whether that necessarily is equivalent to either asking for independence or asking for being part of Russia, that I would not necessarily want to claim, but very clearly the issue is that the arrangements that were made in the early 1990s, or rather that were destroyed in the early 1990s, simply were not satisfactory to people. And then we end up with these very protracted long-term conflicts that are neither resolved nor are they necessarily openly violent conflicts. I think from that perspective, there is a specific problem in the sort of post-Soviet region, but in another sense, I also think it is quite similar to other situations that we have seen, obviously, in the Balkans, in the post-Yugoslav period. But we can also go and look at Africa and Asia and the consequences of decolonization, where in a similar way, the wishes of the people were often not considered and was all about great power politics at the time.
That brings up another question and that I'd like to get addressed here, which is this historic context. I often wonder how much of this is related to how these countries were created post-World War I, World War II, or either the haphazard way those countries were created or the forceful ways that countries were created. Hurst Hannum?
Well, I think it's important to remember that almost every country in the world was created by force. There are very few boundaries that can be considered to be natural. And I think in many respects, the movements that we've seen, not just since the end of the Cold War, but over the last 50 years, reflect a desire either in countries that are very large or in countries where there are different ethnic, linguistic, religious groups for more control over government. As Stefan suggested, self-determination doesn't have to mean a desire for independence. It can be simply a desire for a greater degree of self-government. The Catalans and the Basques in Spain, for instance, or the Scots in the United Kingdom, are home to movements towards independence, even though no one would claim that their identity is in any way being suppressed or repressed. The real problem for outsiders is just how do we respond to these things? Because in every case, the problem is that those who want greater self-government or those who want independence are appealing to outsiders for help. And whether it's the Russian army for the Abkhaz or whether it's the EU for the people in the square of Kiev who complicated the situation, we haven't found a way yet to develop criteria for when states should be allowed to fall apart. It's foolish of us to think that 50 years from now the world will have exactly the same boundaries. And so what we need to do is try to figure out how outsiders should respond to these continuing demands for dissolution.
Stephen Fish.
Yes, this is one of the reasons why the international community has held so sacred boundaries as they exist right now. As Hurst points out, most boundaries are not natural. Most states were formed by force, and I would just add to that, and he already intimated this, that in fact most states are not ethnically homogeneous at all. And for that reason, you could look at virtually any country in the world and find some people in some places that, who would like to secede, have their own province, have their own region, become independent, or join a neighboring state. And the interesting thing, and I think the alarming thing to so much of the international community, and not just the usual suspects who you would expect to be alarmed by this kind of thing, like the United States and its allies in Western Europe, but also the Chinese and people elsewhere in the world, is that the gross violation of this norm by Russia recently to actually invade a neighboring country and annex a piece of that country whose people supposedly want to join the invading country. This is very disturbing because there are 1,000 possible Crimeas in this world, places where this kind of thing could happen. And national boundaries, in fact, perhaps should not be treated as sacred as they have been in the post-war world. As Hurst points out, we still haven't figured out a way to adjust those boundaries for states to fall apart and perhaps reconstitute themselves. And we see in Africa in particular some pretty pathological consequences of reifying and holding in place indefinitely, regardless of population distribution or movements, these post-colonial boundaries. On the other hand, as he points out, we still don't know how to adjust them. One thing I can say for sure, though, is for a neighboring country to invade a territory in one of its adjacent states and annex that piece of territory is not the way to do it. This is not good for the international community. Will not embrace this because this is actually a real threat to peace. This is the kind of thing that could happen, as I say, in 1,000 different areas where one country could invade another's territory and justify that invasion based on a desire for self-determination of the people in that territory. But this is a very dangerous way of doing it. This, to me, is one of the worst ways I can imagine of adjusting boundaries.
These invasions historically have ended in violence, which perhaps is something that we should talk about, too. Some of these autonomous movements have engaged violence. Some have not. Hurst Hanna?
Well, I think all of us are involved in conflict in one way or the other. I'm the lawyer of the group, so perhaps I'm not as well-versed with all of the political niceties. At the same time, while I agree with Stephen that the Russian precedent is a very dangerous one, let's remember how it came about. I mean, Ukraine has been a divided country in many respects for a long time, and there was, if not exactly a coup, at least something that looked a lot like it. in which a democratically elected president who was pro-Russian was sent off packing to Russia, and where those who had organized the demonstration, as their first act, tried to make the speaking of Russian no longer be an official language of the state. Now, that was vetoed by the president, but that's beside the point. A signal was set that Ukraine was suddenly going to become a nationalist Ukrainian state instead of a state that's managed to get along for the last 20 years with these divisions between pro-Russian and pro-Western. So while I'm not trying to justify the Russian invasion by any means, it is important to understand that this is not simply a land grab that looks like, for instance, Saddam Hussein's invasion of Kuwait. It's illegal and unjustifiable, but it's different.
Stefan Wolf.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And I also think that the Crimean case in many ways is more complex than just the self-determination conflict, in the sense that, of course, there's also the issue of the Russian naval base in Sevastopol. And I think that in one way brings us back to the broader issue of geopolitics and why Crimea is really in many ways quite a unique case. But the other thing that I wanted to point out in response to both what Hurst and Stephen have said is also the issue that the boundary issues, the international norm of territorial integrity, is of course one that has been held sacred by states for a variety of different reasons. But there's another norm that I think is equally important, and that's the norm of sovereignty. And you can, on the one hand, spin that around and say there should be no interference whatsoever. But on the other hand, sovereignty is not only a right, it is also a responsibility. And I think in a lot of cases where we do see nonviolent and violent movements of particular segments of the population for self-determination, whether that's more autonomy or independence, states usually have failed in their responsibility to, in a way, accommodate a kind of diversity that might be based in a different ethnicity, different culture, different language, different religion. And I think in a way we need to sort of start at this point before we think about redrawing boundaries and possibly invading other countries, which, I mean, Russia has a track record for, but there are other quite recent precedents, Kosovo among them, where I think it is not too difficult to see the parallel. So I think in that sense, the real question for me as a political scientist always is, well, how can we avoid these potentially very dangerous situations in the first place by putting in place mechanisms that make it actually possible for people of different identities to coexist in a country? They don't necessarily need to love each other, but at least they need to find arrangements in which they can resolve their various disputes in a peaceful and democratic manner.
Can I say something in response to what Stefan just said? I think he makes really good points. I would just add, though, that Ukraine is an example of a country that had been doing a pretty good job at arranging its polity in such a way that people were living in peace, Ukrainian speakers and Russian speakers. This was not a case where there had been much violence at all on the part of Russian speakers against Ukrainian speakers or vice versa. And Putin's justification for moving into Crimea and now his justification for putting pressure on eastern Ukraine that he's somehow protecting these poor Russian speakers against the danger of violence committed on the part of Ukrainians or discrimination is ludicrous. It's true, as Hurst mentioned, that there was this brief moment a couple of weeks ago where the Ukrainian parliament moved toward making Ukraine the national language. That lasted about 2 hours. That was off the table immediately. Ukraine's post-Soviet history has been more of a model than a bad example of how people who speak different languages can get along reasonably well with each other. There has been no major violence or major discrimination against Russian speakers in Ukraine, certainly not in Crimea or in eastern Ukraine. And that's part of why Putin's justification for this whole thing is so bogus, and part of why this invasion, it's very, you know, there's absolutely no justification for it in terms of what Russian speakers were actually living in Ukraine. What they were living was a normal life. Ukraine was more of a model than a problem.
Just a reminder that you're listening to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian, and we're talking about the Crimea vote. Was it self-determination or was it coercion? It sounds like everybody is leading down the path in your comments about what kinds of guidelines or procedures do we need for two parts of this. One is if there is a move for either autonomy or some other kind of self-determination governance or to move with another state. And the other is how to integrate and what those procedures should be to integrate in such a way the various ethnic groups or languages or religions, the diversity, in such a way that is fair for all of the people involved. Stefan Wolf?
This is in many ways quite a tricky legal question, both from an international law point of view, but also from a constitutional law point of view. I mean, for me, looking at as a political scientist, I think every case is usually very, very specific, and there are different historical trajectories and different perceptions that people have of a situation at any given point in a potential territorial or other dispute. So I think from that perspective, I think it's not particularly helpful of thinking about sort of clear guidelines of what to do under what conditions. And I mean, the few attempts that have been made in this respect, like, for example, the Lund recommendations of the High Commissioner on National Minorities of the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, I mean, it's incredibly vague. It offers some good guidelines, but it's all of a non-binding legal nature in the same way in which we don't have any concrete guidelines about the conditions under which states are allowed to fall apart, if you want. In the same way, I think it's very difficult to come up with general guidelines in terms of constitutional arrangements. And looking, for example, across the Western Balkans, the post-Yugoslav space, I mean, you have an incredible range of very, very different arrangements, sort of from an almost confederal arrangement in Bosnia to a form of decentralization in Macedonia and in Kosovo that, although with completely different labels, accomplishes very similar things, even though, of course, Bosnia, in the way in which it was set up in 1995 at the Dayton negotiations, has unfortunately become a very, very dysfunctional state. So I think, in a sense, the question from a constitutional law point of view is how do we balance the demands for both the right of minority groups to be accommodated, to have proper protection of their identity, to have proper mechanisms in place that they can actually live their identity. But on the other hand, we also need functioning states. I mean, we need viable polities, viable democracies, viable market economies that can actually provide a range of public goods to their entire populations without discrimination. And in order to do that, they first of all need to be able to function properly.
Hurst Hunnam, let's bring you back in here. You're the international lawyer. What does international law say, and what is the international community's responsibility?
Well, in short, it says nothing. International law neither recognizes a right of secession under any circumstances, nor does it say that secession is illegal. Secession is, in effect, treated the way civil wars are treated. There have been many who've argued for recognizing what some have called the right to remedial secession. That is, if human rights are violated badly enough and in a discriminatory manner, perhaps we should recognize the rights of those whose rights are being violated to separate from the country. But I think we have to go beyond that, too, because even though people might not have a right to break away, they might still want to. I gave a public talk just last month in Scotland, for instance, which will be holding a referendum in September, whether or not to be independent. The referendum has been accepted by the British government, not that Scotland would automatically become independent, but Scotland's right to hold the referendum. And I think we need to try to find a way of persuading both minorities who wish to secede and majorities who don't want to see their borders changed for any reason whatsoever to look at things much more functionally, much more flexibly. In the days when we have the European Union and many other international arrangements, the state isn't what it used to be. And autonomy or self-governance arrangements should be viewed more favorably by countries. As of the moment, I think the only time that happens is when the country itself is relatively democratic and rights-respecting. neither Canada nor Spain nor the United Kingdom want to see their countries fall apart. But it's difficult to think that there would be a wide-scale civil war if Quebec or Catalonia or Scotland did in fact want to separate. And so we need to keep the focus on the rights of the people who are being affected and try to make borders, if we can, although it's not easy, a bit less relevant in the future than they have been in the past.
Stephen Fish.
I agree with what Hirst just said, and I think that we do have some positive examples. For example, the divorce between, oftentimes called the velvet divorce, between the Czech Republic and Slovakia is something that many people thought would be very problematic. You know, how would people living in the Czech lands live with the idea of the loss of Slovakia? And there was a lot of anticipation at the time that this was going to be highly problematic. But politicians and the public in the Czech Republic made the calculation that maybe this would be better for them as well as for Slovaks. And that divorce actually has worked out reasonably well. In fact, I think you could argue that both Czechs and Slovaks are better off living in separate countries, although they, in ethnic and linguistic terms, are really not terribly different from one another. And there hadn't been violence across the border of the Czech Republic and Slovakia. Still, that worked reasonably well. And as Terce just said, you know, the state isn't what it used to be. And especially in Europe, where you've got supranational entities like the EU, where you've got an overarching entity that's bigger than states themselves, it makes in some way these separation of territory, secession, one could view the Slovak-Czech thing as less of a divorce than a secession of Slovakia from the Czechoslovakia. It makes it easier. And it also means that the whole justification for the existence of this or that state grows weaker. So take Belgium, for example, right now. A lot of Belgians are asking themselves, well, why should we even have a Belgium? Flanders, people who live in the Dutch-speaking parts, and Walloons, people living in the French-speaking parts, have long viewed themselves as really not necessarily part of the same country. And if those two countries were to become independent states within the framework of the EU, folks in both countries, in both parts of the country, might benefit from that. Now, with Brussels being, of course, the capital of Europe in many ways, and Brussels being a divided city, that might be less likely to happen. But I do think we do see some cases where, you know, some change in international norms that indicate that we might be seeing some progress. Again, as Terce says, though, we see this for the most part in, you know, countries that already have well-established democracies, where rights are already respected, where there are, you know, the rule of law does exist. How this can actually happen in places like Russia or Ukraine or in most African polities, though, is an entirely different question.
Stefan Wolf?
Yeah, I would agree with that, in particular with the last point that Stephen made here. I mean, if you look, for example, at the almost velvet divorce that we had between Sudan and South Sudan. I mean, there was a referendum. Everybody agreed that they would accept it. We had the separation of the country in July, now almost 3 years ago. But since then, it's always been completely downhill, both for the process in Sudan and what has happened in South Sudan and what has happened between the two countries. So I think in that sense, there's also a very important lesson here that many, many years earlier, in the early 1990s, we could also see in the case of Ethiopia and Eritrea and their separation. I mean, the separation itself worked quite well, but then they went to war with each other again. So I think the important point here is that separation doesn't resolve anything in itself if it is not very carefully managed. So from that perspective, I would still be much more on the side of those who would say, well, changing boundaries doesn't really help resolve conflicts. I mean, it may terminate one conflict, but at the same time reignite or exacerbate a number of other conflicts. From that perspective, for me, the key issue always remains of how do we manage these processes of trying to find arrangements by which people either can live together or by which they can sort of avoid a very messy and costly divorce. And yes, there are good cases where it has worked reasonably well. I mean,
You could even argue that the disintegration of the Soviet Union as a whole in sort of the course of 1990-1991 was not that badly managed a process. It was the aftermath. What then happened in the individual states and what now sort of comes back to haunt us in the case of Crimea and possibly a host of other countries with ethnic Russians and Russian speakers around Russia, where, again, I mean, the point is not so much how you resolve the conflict, but rather sort of what you do to make sure that the whatever resolution is adopted really is sustainable and provides a degree of stability and security.
Hirst Hannum?
Well, thank you. I think I've finally found a point of at least minor disagreement, and that is on this question of boundaries. There were actually minor boundary adjustments when the Czech Republic and Slovakia separated. And one problem is that we still look at the boundaries that come after countries have divided, like Yugoslavia, for instance, as sacrosanct. And they're simply not. It's a complicated and messy process. But I think what we need to do is to recognize that borders that were drawn by a dictator, which is most of the borders in the world today, need not be respected, and that we need to find a way to allow people within new states as well as old states to express themselves through a series of referenda that are not governed by the presence of foreign troops. And if boundaries need to be withdrawn, then let them be withdrawn. We're never going to do it perfectly. We will never live in a world where every ethnic, religious, cultural group has its own state. It's simply impossible. But to keep newly trapped minorities trapped in new states is just as bad as trying to keep existing minorities trapped in old states. And we need to be open to the possibility of shifting boundaries by peaceful means, not by force.
Thank you, Stephen Fish, Stefan Wolf, and Hirst Hannum for being with us here on the Scholar Circle.
Pleasure.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Stephen Fish is a professor of political science at University of California, Berkeley, and author of award-winning books including Democracy Derailed in Russia, The Failure of Open Politics, Democracy from Scratch, Opposition and Regime in the New Russian Revolution, and Post-Communism and the Theory of Democracy. Stefan Wolf is a professor of international security at the University of Birmingham and the author of Ethnic Conflict, Causes, Consequences, Responses, and co-author of Autonomy, Self-Governance, and Conflict Resolution and Disputed Territories, The Transnational Dynamics of Ethnic Conflict Settlement. Hirst Hannum is professor of international law at Tufts University and author of International Human Rights, Problems of Law, Policy, and Practice, and co-author of Negotiating Self-Determination and Autonomy, Sovereignty, and Self-Determination, The Accommodation of Conflicting Rights. That's it for today's Scholar Circle. Thank you to our guests and to our producers, Melissa Chipranankine Agassian and Leonardo Alanis, for making this show possible. Also to Sud Dongre, our webmaster, and most of all to you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can go back to kpfk.org and click on the archives, or to our own archives at armudian.com and scholarcircle.org. You can also subscribe to our podcast through Stitcher or iTunes, and follow us on Twitter at armudian.